My name's Charlie Banner of Keating Chambers. Can I start by reminding our viewers to consider making a charity donation in lieu of a registration fee. We have a whole range of charities we support, details of which and links to which are on our website, www.hwgpnfy. We got planetyfew.com. Or, of course, make a... it doesn't sound so good as it looks, does it, when you read it out like that? Or of course, make a donation to a charity of your choice. Now, we are delighted this evening to be welcoming Chris Webber, Group Planning Manager at Barratt, here to talk about the CMA report on the house building sector, a hugely important document which has been much discussed recently. So, Chris, we're hugely looking forward to hearing your input and comments on that, in an interview led by Paul. Wonder where Paul is today. We shall soon find out. Where is Paul?
He's there.
I'm to pay homage. Invaded my room. So thank goodness I have. He's in my pupil desk. there. Now, first and foremost, let's introduce. Well, I should say first of all, Chris, where are you dining us? What were you calling us from today? Chosen anything with our theme, and what, if anything, are you drinking?
So, dialing in from Barratt's East London office, over in Stratford in Heary, so just by the Olympic Park, a really great setting. And I've got a very nice lemon and ginger herbal tea.
Ah, that's very wholesome of you. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming. And obviously, as I always say, is there anything you'd like to comment on any of our case reports before we have the interview, feel free to do so, although no obligation. Mary, different angle for, and I can't quite work out with you at home, Town Legal, or somewhere.
I am in one of the new pods in Town Legal's refurbished offices. So, good evening, Charlie. Lovely to see you. Welcome to the show, Chris. Chris Webber, as opposed to Chris, the lovely Chris Young. And I'm really looking forward to the interview later.
Lovely. Great to see you, Mary. Sasha, you're in a sauna by the look of it.
You're not the first to say that today. It's actually my hotel room decor.
We believe you. Good, not.
I'm in the delights of Courchevel skiing, which I thought Mary might still be with me, but no. But I'm in a slightly more glam. I'm only showing you my hotel room because I'm proving that it's nicer than Chris's.
Very good. Very good. Well, great to see you, Sasha. Chris, you have one of, I think, as far as I can see, you have behind you one of my favourite pieces. Is that David Hockney's Pear Blossom Highway?
It is, yes. Although I obviously don't have any original Hockneys. That is from my room in Chambers. I'm moving between Chambers whilst I'm still at number 5, but we're moving to a new building up. And I am in a hotel in Maidenhead. I'm in the Royal Ascot Suite, obviously. We had a theme. Have we asked Chris about his theme?
What is the theme, Chris? I did ask. I didn't get an answer. I didn't like to say. We're not allowed to do that on this show.
I feel terribly. No, my theme is adventure holidays.
Uh-huh.
And me and my wife have got a real kind of love for adventure holidays, going to exotic places, always hit the theme on the head. Going to a lot of different countries and doing a lot of very adventurous things, so jumping off cliffs, canyoning, co-steering, zip lining, doing what I found out earlier in the year was a Tarzan jump, which is essentially just go on a platform above the tree line and just do a straight 45 meter drop down before you start swinging. So anything like that is it's just fantastic. So I thought it was a great thing.
I need to know what you were wearing when you were doing that Tarzan jump.
Bubble wrap. Well, at least Sasha's always taking CP there. So you've actually gone on another ski holiday in order to give effect to the theme.
And do ask Paul, please, Charlie. He's got that backdrop. Do ask him.
Yes, I'm going to have to. Paul, tell us about the backdrop.
Well, I hate adventure holidays. You're going to have to mute Charlie if I'm in the same room. I hate adventure holidays. That definitely isn't me jumping off the Zambezi Gorge last summer. I wouldn't do anything so stupid. There are no crocodiles there. Nor was I egged into doing it by my family. I go on beach holidays and nothing else, Chris. But it's a delight to see you.
And I have to say, Charlie, yeah. now you've remembered the theme, Lonely Planet. Anybody else a fan of Lonely Planet?
Oh, yes.
I have been to 100 countries using Lonely Planet. I absolutely love it. I love your theme. And I particularly like deserts. So that's why I've got my David Hockney. Anyway, we've almost remembered to do the order right, Charlie. Almost.
Almost. Thanks, mate. I think I haven't got anybody, have I? No, hooray. In which case, we're going to start with Marks and Sparks. And who better about the decision than Mary Cook?
Thank you very much, Charlie. So this is a decision of Natalie Leven, J, allowing a Section 288 challenge and quashing the Secretary of State's dismissal of M&S's Section 78 appeal for the construction of a new 9-storey mixed office and retail store at the western end of Oxford Street. In other words, the redevelopment of their flagship, their current flagship store. Now, there were 6 grounds to this challenge. The first ground was that the Secretary of State had erred in respect of paragraph 152 of the National Planning Policy Framework when he said in paragraph 24 of the decision letter that there is, and I quote, a strong presumption in favour of repurposing and reusing buildings. There is, in fact, no mention of the word presumption in what was then paragraph 152 of the MPPF, which is now 157 of the December 23 version. And that's the one that talks about the planning system supporting the transition to a low carbon future in a changing climate, taking full account of various risks. So that was the first ground of the challenge. And as I say, the claimant pointed out that there wasn't actually the word presumption in that paragraph in the MPPF. Moreover, that there are paragraphs in the MPPF which do use the expression presumption. And therefore, of course, if the draftsman wanted to create a presumption in relation to 152, now 157, he would have done so. And the Secretary of State didn't have the submissions made on his behalf alleged that it was the stated intention of paragraph 152 to create radical reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And it was open, it was argued, to the Secretary of State as a matter of planning judgment and weight to apply a policy presumption. Well, the judge wasn't having any of that. She thought it was absolutely plain that the Secretary of State had misinterpreted the MPPF and therefore erred in law, and that ground was successful. The second ground of challenge related to the consideration of alternatives, and here the inspector had concluded that there was no meaningful refurbishment which could achieve the planning policy objectives. And the judge said that whilst it would have been open to the Secretary of State to disagree with the expert inspector, this is David Nicholson, architect, it would have been open to the Secretary of State to disagree with that judgment, he would have needed to give adequate reasons as to why he disagreed. And in this particular instance, he had failed to give those adequate reasons. And so that ground of challenge was successful. Again, ground 3, Secretary of State, it was said, had erred in the balance of public benefits as against the heritage impacts. The judge found that there was an obvious inconsistency in the decision letter where, on the one hand, limited weight had been given to the potential harm to the vitality and viability of the area from a refusal, but yet significant weight had been given to the benefits which would have been lost if, of course, the scheme did not proceed. So there was a sort of inconsistency, and again, that ground was successful. Ground 4, the Secretary of State's conclusion on harm to the vitality and viability of Oxford Street was one upon which it was said that there was no evidential basis. Now, you may all recall that M&S had said that they would leave. They would leave Oxford Street if they didn't get the planning permission. And that if planning permission was not granted, the inspector concluded that indeed would be harmful. That scenario would have been harmful to the vitality and viability of what is an international town centre. And once again, although the Secretary of State appeared to disagree, he didn't give adequate reasons. And so again, that ground was challenged. was successful. So Ground 5 was all about embodied carbon. And this is where the judge said that the Secretary of State had become thoroughly confused on the difference between embodied carbon, which emanates from the construction of buildings, as distinct from carbon emissions, which emanate from the operational phase of a development. And there's a London Plan Policy, SI2, which relates, which has a policy, an offsetting policy. And the Secretary of State said that there was a breach of this policy, but that was because the Secretary of State mistakenly thought that that policy related to embodied carbon when it didn't. It actually related to carbon emissions during the operational phase of a development. And so, again, this was a successful round of the challenge. So there was a sixth round, which wasn't successful, but the challenge succeeded on all five grounds. So the matter is going to be remitted, and we wait with interest to see what the final outcome will be, and also what process, what if any process, i.e. a reopened inquiry, written reps, the Secretary of State decides to follow. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Mary. And not the only judicial review or statutory review to succeed in the last couple of years. Often said it's very difficult to get a planning court claim off the ground. On the face of that decision that was challenged, it looked like it might be difficult for Marks and Spencers, but well done to the claimants' team. And well done to the claimants' team in the next case that I'm going to cover. It's been a successful fortnight for Galloway. Ian Galloway, that is. Ian Galloway, the claimant in a judicial review or statutory review of a decision by Durham County Council to grant planning permission for a solar farm development in the Durham area. The ground of challenge, the grounds of challenge were broadly focused on the size of the solar farm. The claimant's concern was that the scale of the infrastructure in question took it over the statutory threshold of 50 megawatts for a solar farm to be a nationally significant infrastructure project. And so the claimant said, well, hang on, this is, in essence, an NSIP. It shouldn't have been granted by the County Council pursuant to the local Town and Country Planning Act process. The response to that was, well, the nature of the permission was such that the infrastructure could only be used to the extent that it was below the statutory capacity, 49.5 megawatts. And therefore, although if the infrastructure was running at full pelt, not a term of art, but essentially at full pelt, it would be above the conditions and nature of the permission was such that it couldn't be used in that way, and therefore was legitimate for them to have granted permission under the Town and Country Planning Act. Now, on that aspect of the case, the judge, Mr. Justice Fordham, rejected the argument. What the judge said, in essence, was that the claimant's approach to defining statutory capacity, the capacity of the solar farm, which wasn't defined in legislation, was not a legally mandatory approach. The approach they call the combined panels method of totting up the potential capacity of the solar farm, and also that the conditions and the plans which were tied into the conditions of the planning permission were such that it couldn't be used above the threshold. So that aspect of the claim failed. However, Mr. Justice Fordham went on to accept an alternative line of challenge to the effect that this was an excessive use of the land in question, because essentially the defence of the first ground, namely that the infrastructure, if it was happening in Fort Pelt, would be above, but actually it was effectively dialed down. The effect of that was that obviously material consideration, which the county hadn't taken into account and should have done, it was irrational not to, was that too much land was being used, the solar farm, because it didn't need to be that excessive, because it was only being used below its technical capacity. quite a clever and alternative argument when they say that the defence of the first argument proved too much. And for a variety of reasons set out in judgment, Mr. Justice Forden accepted that argument and held that it was irrational, essentially, of the County Council not to have taken that argument into account. Well done again to the claimant, because it's in that case, because it's jolly hard to make good an irrationality argument. So Richard Harwood Casey and his team did very well. But it's an illustration, actually, both those cases, that despite the well-documented difficulties of making good a claim in the planning court, it is possible, including in this case, on rationality grounds. So that's Galloway. And next, before we turn to the news and then the interview, next up, Sasha, you've got a planning appeal in Leicester. So over to you in your sauna.
Right. Thank you, Charlie. Yeah, I wish you were with me. Now, you've talked about irrationality. I'm literally putting forward a candidate for the Barmidst appeal decision in the lifetime of Have We Got Planning News to You. I'll tell you a few reasons why. This is Charnwood Borough Council. Charnwood Borough Council have a plan which is from 2004. There is an application by Taylor Wimpey for up to 195 houses. And surprisingly, or maybe not unsurprisingly, and I don't want to get on one of Chris's hobby horses, but there was an emerging plan which has had an EIP which closed in November. Now, just think what the emerging plan says about this site. Does it A, shunt it into Siberia, or does it B, allocate the site for housing? It B, allocates the site for housing. So imagine we've got a planning inquiry in November which is simultaneous with the closure of an EIP where the site is allocated under draft policy HA3 for up to 195 dwellings. I'm trying to get my head round why this has gone to appeal. And I mean, Chris will listen to this with interest, although it's another house builder, Taylor Wimpey application. The reasons, why would the council objecting? Well, apparently the main issue is whether the development accords with the council's development plan strategy. Now, remember what I said, this is a development plan from 2004. Which is a painful year for me because it was the last time Arsenal were champions, but it shows how long ago this plan was adopted, 2004. And I'm bemused why the council thought it was sensible, reasonable, or any kind of sensible person would come to a view to take this to a planning inquiry when apparently it's an allocation that they are supporting simultaneously in an EIP. Well, not unsurprisingly, the inspector said, all very interesting, but the tilted balance, which is in play because, of course, the plan is so old, it's almost of a vintage. But, of course, the inspector applies the tilted balance and says the benefits are overwhelmingly in favour of the grant of consent. The only mystery, and I might be wrong about this, but apparently on the face of the report is there was no application for costs from Taylor Wimpey. That's the only mystery of this case, frankly. But it really is an example of and it's one of those that Chris loves, but an example, frankly, why it's slightly bemusing why it went to appeal. If anyone who was involved in that can illuminate us by putting something on the question and answer, I'll be interested. But frankly, it's a case study into why the planning system is failing with delivery. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Sasha. We're now going to go to Chris's roundup of news stories, which we've decided to do at the end of the session before interview, by complete design.
It's all beautifully planned, Charlie. I'm sure you didn't forget at all. I tell you why, Sasha. Actually, I've been in Charnwood. Their EIP reopened, but it doesn't undermine at all what you were saying. It was just on a couple of discrete points, because the council have refused everything that is a draft allocation, everything. And the only way they've got through, as Paul knows, is you go to appeal. And the council just continually do this, and I don't honestly know what their rationale for it is. And now the plan's only 12 years, because this has been going on, the examination has been going on for 3 years, the plan's only 12 years from adoption. Anyway, my goodness, what a busy week. The government has made all kinds of announcements in the budget, There's £3 million for skills and education to attract more planners into the profession. £20 million. I sound like a Tory government minister. £20 million investment in social finance for building 3,000 community led homes. That's 6,500 per house. The government is funding more local nutrients mitigation to try and unlock 30,000 houses. There's money for Cambridge. There's money for Leeds. Class MA, which is part three of the GBDO, which is class E to class C3 for the enthusiast. And that is now releasing paragraph A, which is it needed to be vacant for a 3-month continuous period, and paragraph C, which is the cumulative floor space cap of 1,500 square meters. There's been so much going on, but whilst the government's been busy doing that, and who knows, it could be an election coming. At the same time, the consequences of their policies are being seen. So Spelthorn last week decided to delete 13 of their 15 sites in the Greenbelt. Solihull has decided one of the options is to abandon their plan and start all over again. So lots of investment from the government, but I'm afraid things are starting to go wrong with local plans as a consequence of abandoning their housing targets. And finally, I have to mention the Banner Review on infrastructure. It was with great enthusiasm Charlie was telling us about the continued value in judicial review. But part of your investigation, I think, is to look at the success of these judicial reviews and the effect they're having on the delivery of infrastructure. And you're looking at planning and development. So congratulations on your appointment. It'll be interesting to see what you say about the merits of judicial review. Wow, what a busy week.
Thanks, Chris.
Oh, sorry. Bristol and St Albans became the first authorities to be put into special measures because of their speed of decision-making on non-major applications. And some might say that's just 14 years too late.
Thanks, Chris. A quiet week, as you say, in the field of planning.
So, Chris Webber, Group Planning Manager at Barratt Developments PLC. You have a first-class degree in geography from the University of Reading. Now that tells me I'm starting to talk as if you've got a job interview. You're not. You started as an assistant planner in Chelmsford back as recently as August 2018. Since when you've had a meteoric rise, joining Barratt's East of England team in November 2021, and now you are Group Planning Manager for the PLC, despite the fact you have extraordinary youthful good looks, Chris. So firstly, what does your role entail? When was your last adventure holiday? And what's your secret?
Well, firstly, flattery gets you everywhere, Paul, so thanks very much for that. I'll tackle the last holiday first before I get into sort of professional life. But my last holiday was earlier this year to Costa Rica, which was absolutely fantastic. It's a really kind of long-held aspiration for me and my wife to go there. So we did a two-week kind of all-in adventure holiday, which was a fantastic group-led, loads of activities traveling across Costa Rica. So yes, and then turning to my role as Group Planning Manager in Barratt. So I have had my previous experience was very much development management over in East Anglia, managing reserve matters, full applications, NMAs, the whole kind of spectrum for Barratt in that neck of the woods. And then in November 2021, got kind of poached by our group land and planning director, Philip Barnes, to be group planning manager at Barratt. So yeah, it was a real upward step for me. It's been a massive learning curve. But my role now is very much twofold. One is much more internal, so it's working with our divisional teams, making sure they are delivering planning permissions, promoting land to allocation efficiently, and kind of providing them the support, guidance, anything they need internally, direct involvement in applications to help them do that. And then more of the kind of external facing role, it's very much engaging with policy, going to meetings with government, with the HBF, LPDF to try and steer that government policy and make sure Barratt as the largest national house builder have an input and have helped to shape that. And then for much of last year, as you'll probably get onto, a large part of my role was engaging with the CMA.
So Chris, So you were brought on board, or we asked you to come on to talk about the Competition and Markets Authority report, which was published last week. There's a further investigation which they've set in train, which we're not going to talk about because it's still live. But on the report that's been produced so far, what are the key conclusions for Barratt from the report, and particularly in relation to land use and planning issues?
I think from our perspective, it is a very, very positive report. And I think it can't be kind of overstated the robustness of that report. You know, the CMA have the power to go in to house builders, look at internal request internal documents, which they did so with Barratt, the huge amount of internal work collating and giving that over. So it's probably the most robust report probably ever conducted, at least in my lifetime, into house building. And then the conclusions they came to really was, you know, despite being out of scope in the initial review, despite Michael Gove explicitly saying you shouldn't be looking at planning, the planning system is now front and center of why the house building market has underdelivered, why we're not meeting our need, why we're not delivering 300,000 homes a year. So I think that, you know, for that to be an outcome, first and foremost, that, you know, to go in saying you're not looking at planning and then to have planning system front and center, and to really echo a lot of what I've said, what Barratt have said, what other house builders and the wider industry have said, and to have that backed up by such a robust report is fantastic. So planning aside, it also then looked into land banking, and that's often wheeled out against house builders. And again, that was really good to see that, you know, the CMA, having looked at everything internal, everything that we put together internally and the wider industry do, and say land banking's not a problem. It is a symptom of the planning system we operate in. And I think their exact terms are, it's a rational response to the complexity and the uncertainty of the planning system. So house builders need to have those land banks, which again is a really positive outcome and that we can lean on and talk about. Again, really positive to see there was no instances of competition issues in any area of the UK. You know, it is an inherently competitive market. Again, really great to see. There was an interim kind of letter report issue that said there might be some areas of concern. They went away, looked at those areas, no concerns. So there's no competition issues in any area of the UK. And then I think probably lastly for me, it was just identifying that, you know, there needs to be more planning permissions coming out of the system. That's the only way we are going to increase the number of homes delivered and get to where we need to be.
So it will come as no shock to any of our viewers, I think, that the problems that have been identified by the CMA report are said to be that the planning system is hindering the delivery of homes. I'm sure that many of our viewers will be astonished by that conclusion. So if the planning system is a key driver of underperformance, what are the biggest issues that have been identified by the CMA in terms of their recommendations?
So, you know, overarching, it's got to be that there's just not enough coming out of the system. So sorry, I'm kind of repeating myself what I just said, but you know, that is fundamentally it. There is not enough coming out of the system to deliver 300,000 homes a year, which is the target we all need to get to. I can't remember what year Lichfields did it, but there's a great Lichfields report that says we need around 520,000 consented a year, or consented units, to come through, and we're nowhere near that. We're at the mid 200s, and that figure's been declining. You've only got to look at, you know, the data that's come out of the last couple of months, the last years, to see that's on a downward trajectory. So that is one of the key issues identified. Secondly, it's that complexity, the uncertainty, the time, the kind of excessive time in the planning system as well. And looking at some of the stats, the CMA will out, only 12% of applications, I think, were determined in time. The average cost of an application is between 100 and 900,000. That's obviously a very wide-ranging average, independent on size. But again, you know, those time delays, so how that they're not determined in statutory time periods, the average time scale for a planning application is 12 months. Cost 12 months is costing you up to 900 grand to get in. That is hugely exclusionary to a lot of market actors. People like Barratt, a lot of more well-funded organizations can work within those parameters. There's a lot of SMEs, the kind of businesses we should be encouraging, cannot deal with that context. So again, a fundamental issue. And then an interesting one was actually looking at the availability of land. That was a really interesting outcome in terms of planning land, saying actually the availability of land isn't really an issue. And I think it's 44% of England is potentially developable or could come forward for development. Of that 44%, 10% is brownfield. So that already shows that, you know, a brownfield presumption or entirely brownfield only will not work, will not deliver the homes we need. But actually, you know, to bring land forward, it's actually the planning certainty. If you don't, if you're going to be spending 12 months, 100 to 900,000, with no certainty you're going to get a positive decision as a landowner or as a developer, why would you bring that land forward?
Yeah, it's interesting to drill into the stats, and it's certainly a report that I would invite anybody interested in the planning system and why there's failure to drill into. But one of the things I that struck me is that there's been separate reports issued by the CMA for England, Wales and Scotland. They've not covered Northern Ireland because it has a different system. But I'm afraid I can't resist the temptation to note that the nation which has the closest thing to proper regional planning and the greatest clarity as to what housing requirements must be met is the one that's the closest to meeting its national housing target, which is a big up to the Scots. So Sasha's team there in the rugby world. So is that worthy of note, do you think, Chris?
I think it definitely is. Probably I would just say with a caveat. So I'll kind of tackle the yes, why it should be of note in a second. But I think it's important that you've got your starting point's got to be none of the regions have a housing target that is actually truly reflective of need. And I know we're talking about, I'll go into Scotland in a minute, but, you know, looking at England, we've got a target of 300,000. All of the standard method only adds up to around 225. I think without the arbitrary sort of urban uplift applied. So actually that's got to be a starting point on that. I think we can't get away from needing those national targets. But then actually what you've picked out in terms of Scotland with that regional planning system is that there's scope to adopt that and improve it, I think, across the rest of the regions. Because if you start with a strong national target, you can then feed that down into regional, you know, probably light touch regional plans within that. So you have that strong housing target, and that is then set at a strong level and a very unambiguous level regionally as well. And I think that's where we can kind of build on the Scottish model. So do we look at something like, you know, harking back to the old kind of RPG guidance, very light touch, specific regions, whether that's, you know, urban areas and their surrounding authorities or something as big as the kind of Oxcam Arc or Oxfordshire, you know, regions to be determined. But do we look at that set those housing targets, that national target is distributed regionally. It then sets the infrastructure priorities for that region. And then all the local plans just feed into that. There then shouldn't be any talk around, well, who does what, who goes where. You've got a number, you've got your economic and your infrastructure priorities, everyone's got to meet it. And I think that's probably a key lesson to be learned.
Yeah, it's that interim position between a national target of 300,000 and the local target for someone like Charlwood, just based upon the standard methodology. They just need to know what your figure is and then go away and plan for it.
Exactly.
This isn't rocket science. Now, developers do come in for criticism in the report, but... what do you read the commission, the competition market conclusion as to where the blame actually lies for the under-delivery of housing? Is it the developers, is it the landowners, or is it somewhere else on your reading?
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of land and planning, I can obviously really only talk about the areas where the CMA conclusions are really clear. I said land banking doesn't exist, it's a rational response to that. The planning system is not generating enough permissions. You know, there is very valid points made in the CMA report around how developers build to local absorption rates and build rates, which I'm sure we'll get into. But again, you can't get away from the model of house building in the UK is inherently speculative. It's tied to economic headwinds. It's tied to the laws of demand and supply. In that, we can't really get away from that. But fundamentally, you know, whether we talk about build out rates, we talk about speeding up the developer, how quickly developers build out sites, you've got to have the next site ready to go on that. And at the minute, we're in a system that doesn't have that next site ready to go in there. So I think you've got to hark back to that, to essentially the planning system and making sure everything from top to bottom is, you know, through a plan-led system is generating those sites coming through.
And how authoritative do you take this report to be? I mean, is it up there with the Letwin report at that calibre, or is it just yet another report that sits on a shelf? How do you read this?
I very much hope it's should hold more weight than, you know, the Letwin review, Barker, those things, because of the powers that the CMA has. I said, as far as I'm aware, and feel free to correct me, I don't think, you know, Letwin had the ability to go in and review internal house builder documents. So, you know, you've got such a wide-ranging review, all coming to essentially the same conclusions that everyone has, but this should be seen as so much more robust. So I think we're just really hoping that the government will listen and that they will work with housebuilders, they'll work with, you know, experts in the industry like like yourselves and you know, the people listening to the call, to actually look to deliver the recommendations there, because this absolutely shouldn't sit on a shelf. This is a must read for everyone in the industry to understand what's going on.
Just jump in and say it's wonderfully reassuring for me to know that Paul has a sliding scale of authority of public review reports. No pressure. I look forward to hearing where on the sliding scale of the Tucker scale of my report ends up landing.
I'm going to plead the fifth on that one. Okay, so one of the points in the report is the issue about the emphasis on build out rate, which Mary's going to pick up in terms of local absorption, etc. But do you think this is going to lead to changes to require permissions to be built out within a specific time limit?
I believe it will, and I think that kind of probably builds on some of the kind of rhetoric that's already been talked about. You know, you've had through, I think it was the Levelling Up, the Lura commencement notices, completion notices. So I think we've already started to see that come through quite a lot. So and I think this will only kind of embolden that and bring those types of methods forward of trying to drive build out rates. But I think fundamentally it's great you can encourage developers or force developers, so to speak, to build out sites faster, but you've got to have something that works alongside that. So whether that is a diversity of tenure on site, for example, bringing in more players to the market, deliver more units alongside that, because if you increase those build out rates, all you're going to do is increase the rate of when homes are delivered, not actually how many homes are going to be delivered, because you'll come to the same end point, which is, well, great, I was forced to do that site faster. Where's my next one? It's not there.
Yeah, it's the holistic approach. It's not just simply the numbers of any individual sites. So the CMA's report on the planning system makes what, certainly to my reading, are comparatively familiar recommendations. So reduce determination periods, require more rapid consultee responses, speed up plan making, etc. But I'm interested in relation to those recommendations or build out rates to drive more non-speculative house building, which I mean RSLs, etc. So the CMA identified this as a potential opportunity area. Even self-build, Chris will be pleased to hear. Is it realistic?
I think you've got to support any effort that gets more, to use maybe a bit of a poor analogy, more players on the pitch. That you've got to have more people in the market delivering homes, you know, whether that is through the speculative model, through us, and whether that is more self-build, custom-build, it's more RPs doing more. You know, there was a great change to, I think, grant funding last year, which allowed them to invest in estate regeneration as long as it delivered more homes. But obviously since then, there's a massive increase in the kind of retrofit challenge and the amount of funds that RPs need to sink into existing stock. So you need to kind of find a way to get those players back involved and back in and delivering new homes. You look at build to rent, private rental sector, you know, again, an absolute space in the market for them, but they've got to be delivering the right sorts of homes. It's all well and good saying, yes, that's brilliant, let's increase the amount of non-speculative house building, but is it delivering the sorts of homes that the country needs? You know, it's great, you know, rental towers going up in a lot of the big urban areas. Yes, there is that is soaking up a need, but is it where the most need is? So I think there's absolutely scope for those players, but it needs to be the right types of homes delivered. And then, you know, looking at self-build, custom-build, again, absolutely a place for them. And I think we're seeing local plans, certainly Barra, seeing local plans come through where there's an increase in requirement, whether that's 5%, 10%, whatever percentage of strategic allocations have to be allocated to self-build or custom-build, which is great. But actually, can you go one step further than that? Because actually, do a lot of self-builders want to build their dream home, their, you know, fantastic architecturally designed home on part of a larger development site?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not convinced. So actually, is there more fundamental change in terms of a set percentage or a set number of units that have to come through a local plan on our set self-build, custom-build sites? Are there more actors that can help to deliver that? I don't know.
So final question for me before handing over to the others. What do you envisage will happen from here?
Well, fundamentally, I just hope the government will listen and they will engage with the industry. There was a helpful email that I hadn't actually spotted before, but it came out from the HBF yesterday, I believe, that the DLUHC have committed to responding in 3 months, I think, from the issue of the report, which was a helpful flag. I hadn't realised that. So I kind of, from our perspective, we just hope that response is informed by talking, by engaging with that report, and by talking to the people who were essentially involved in putting that report together and giving the evidence to the CMA. So 3 months is the initial starting point, and beyond that, who knows? But hopefully it's positive in it, and whatever changes come forward are aligned with, roughly aligned with what the CMA say.
And thank you, Chris. Mary, do you have a question for Chris?
Yes, as you mentioned, I'm going to come back to this absorption rate point. So the report identifies that house builder build-out rates are aligned to local absorption rates, which is sometimes less than theoretically what developers could build out over a period of time. So my question really is that inevitable, or could delivery be tweaked in order to influence the model?
That's a very good question. I suppose taking a personal standpoint, I think it is inevitable. I think the kind of large and the major house builder model is inherently speculative. You've got to take a plausible, realistic assumption on secondhand prices, the rate you're going to deliver that, the rate that you can sustain those prices, because that's what you put forward in the land bid. So you're governed by those kind of laws of supply and demand, like I said before, the kind of economic headwinds that sit behind them. So I think it is inevitable to a degree, but I think you've got to, when we're talking about increasing supply and increasing the number of homes delivered, you've got to work with that and, like I said, get those more players, get more diversity, I think, on sites, on strategic allocations. For example, getting developers to look at, there was the deal that Barratt did last year with Citra for rental to offload a large amount of housing, because that was immediate delivery and we could get people moved into those homes as soon as possible. So I think it all comes back to getting that diversity of tenure. More permissions means you're going to be delivering more, you're going to be delivering a greater variety of homes.
I mean, we could, I might add a little bit of a follow-up. I mean, it's quite an interesting point as to whether in the future planning policy seeks to put an onus, as it were, on house builders to open up, through policy, through 106 obligations. That might be another way of tweaking the model, as it were, rather than the sort of harsh planning permission now, if you don't build them all out by X, you lose the permission.
So how do you mean when you say kind of open up through?
Well, you're suggesting that really one of the solutions is more players. And I'm saying if a local authority is reliant on a very large strategic site, they might in the future have a planning policy which seeks to obligate them to open up that site to more.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. Where currently, policy doesn't tend to do that.
Yeah, I fully get that, and I think fully support that, and I think that should be considered. I think you've got these large sites that, like I said, some of them may have a small percentage for self-build, for example, but I think there can be a lot more that's done there. Maybe some more thought that's gone into those policies. There's going to be probably some fundamental change sitting behind that to, you're right, open up those strategic sites and actually look at really how are those brought forward, and it's not the kind of the traditional model for that. So I think there is absolutely scope.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mary. I never thought you'd be the advocate for a command economy. That's one to come back to. Talking of which, Chris, do you have a question for Chris?
Yeah, I do. Nice link there, Paul. I mean, it does say in the report, doesn't it, that planning takes a protracted time. And so they recognise there's obviously a delay problem. I found reading it, it was like therapy in many ways. Everything that you say and you think and you get frustrated about is there. And I agree with you, you want it to be listened to. I mean, one thing which would help would if we didn't have to have all these appeals into allocated sites. Hey, guess what? I'm in Maidenhead and I've got a 2-week inquiry on a site that's allocated for 350 houses. We're promoting 350 houses and it was recommended for approval with no technical objections. So it would help. And then James and Ricci is up the road in Buckinghamshire and he's got another one that started on Tuesday. I mean, that's got to stop, frankly. But what would you say are three things that could really speed the system up now? I'm asking for a friend.
I think you can't get away. Your number one has got to be resourcing LPAs properly. You can't shy away from that. And I think the pots that have been announced by government, whether you call it the super squad, whether you call it backlog busting, that is just not enough. That is fundamentally not. But I can't remember what the funding was. 26 million. What's that? Maybe one planner in every LPA for 1 year. I think that's what it comes down to. If that.
Yeah, yeah. 3 million for and talking about really what officer for each authority, probably.
Yeah, that is fundamentally not enough. LPAs continue to be in an absolutely critical resourcing position, and that means you're getting their workload soaked up by appeals, by almost kind of needless work a lot of the time. If we're going to deliver 300,000 homes a year or increase that above 300,000 homes a year, that's got to equate to more investment into local planning authority. There's no getting around it. You can't tweak the system here and there and almost make do amend with the resource that already exists. You've got to get more resource in. There's no two ways about it, and that's the only way you're going to do that is through funding, and whether that is straight funding pots, whether that is actually exploring ring fencing properly and not 88% of people responding saying you should ring fence and then saying we're deciding not to ring fence it. So you've got to get the funding, you've got to raise, maybe that's raising planning fees, ring fencing those fees, but making sure that that's allocated to LPA resourcing. And then secondly, and kind of links, I suppose, your kind of intro to this question, and I don't know whether it'll be a bit contentious, but I'm really in favour of something like a national scheme of delegation, or at least harmonising LPA schemes of delegation in that. So do you have a site that is, actually Barrett have got examples where it's an allocated site, so it's democratically approved. You've got, it then gets outline permission, again, democratically approved at committee. You then get reserve matters and it's refused at committee and goes to appeal because it was called in on a spurious reason. There was no evidence behind it, but it was called in for a spurious reason, went to committee and went down. And now we're 5 months, 6 months into an appeal process in that. So do we need to look at, is there, if it has gone through a certain number of stages, is officers determine it to be in line with all the relevant adopted local plan policies, is that something that should go through on a delegated decision? And I think that there's, local authorities are so different. You've got reserve matters that will go through on, 500-600 homes that will go through on a delegated approval. And then you've got schemes for 50 units, which have to be reported to committee. Even if everyone's on board, they have to go to committee, which increases that risk. So I think there's a real opportunity area there, which is a very personal opinion, like I said, maybe a bit contentious. And then thirdly, I guess maybe a little bit left field, but I try to engage a lot with the deemed discharge of planning condition provisions, which they, introduced, I think 9-10 years ago, 2015, I think it was. But they've got so many caveats to them. They're just not well used. And conditions are essentially a real drag on officer time when they should be dealing with the applications and the schemes that that matter and deliver homes. Not to say the conditions aren't important, but they should be focusing on those. Sometimes needlessly held up by statutory consultees. So actually, could you look at an expansion of those deemed discharge provisions that will just open up sites coming forward, that you're not waiting on days, months, weeks, years for conditions to be discharged, and in some instances, never discharged at all? So that would be my probably left field final one.
Well, thank you very much. I have to say, I can see why you got your job, for goodness sake. And that second one, you had a little nodding. So thank you very much. Cheers. Cheers, Paul.
Thank you very much, Chris. Sasha, do you have a question for us?
I do. Thank you, Paul. Chris, you've just talked about delegation, etc. Let's be rational and reasonable in the sense that obviously the politicians are incredibly powerful in the planning system, and the politicians are heavily influenced by local residents, objectors, interest groups, etc. And we're in an era where many locals feel incredibly angry about new development proposals. And I just wondered, what's the approach of Barratt to kind of changing the current status quo, which is general anger, if not fury, towards a lot of the proposals that you find your companies involved in? How are you addressing to change the dynamic of the perception of your developments?
Mm-hmm. So we've done a lot of work internally looking at how we engage with the community, because it's and so we've produced like a community consultation toolkit, best practice guide, for instance, internally that all our divisions should be using. We're in the midst of a project with Well North Enterprises, which is run by Lord Mawson, looking at how we can capture social value and drive social value creation in our schemes. But that's kind of what we're doing. But fundraising, that's driven by, you need to go in and understand what communities want at the very start. I think, you know, that there's a sense which, yeah, you'll never completely overcome it, but there's always a sense of, well, I'm having these homes thrust upon me and I'm seeing absolutely nothing in return. And I think developers, you know, maybe are, but also can do more to actually get into the throes of the local community, do the research, go in, meet people, meet groups to understand what that community want. Can a scheme, can our scheme deliver that, or can an allocation deliver that? And actually deliver it as we say we're going to deliver it, you know, do what you say you're going to do. And again, we've had schemes, what one rings a bell, that I used to do a bit of work on in Essex, where you know, huge public and political kind of outcry to the scheme. It's just a reserve matters, but huge outcry to it. But we actually, you know, went in there, laid the groundwork, met with the people, understood the concerns that they had with the site, the neighbours, and worked with them and delivered things over and above what the 106 had. We delivered we were speaking to the parish council. They had a local village war memorial, for example. It was really poorly used on a road junction, you know, in November. It's going to be a horrendous it could be a really horrendous weather, for example. It just wasn't able to be used. So we'd, okay, well, what about if we've got space, we've got huge amounts of POS, why don't we relocate and we'll create a really nice memorial space, recreate this in our scheme? And that went down fantastically. Really well used, you know, had a great launch, had, you know, the local MP down there, everyone out there that would usually visit that memorial now did it on our site, and they're seeing the benefits that can be brought to a community. So I think you've got to do that. You've got to build on that, and you can't underestimate or get away from engaging the community, identifying what they want, and then delivering on what they want, and then, and being, quite frankly, from a developer standpoint, shouting about it and saying, this is what we've done. And you never get a win over 100% of hearts and minds, but I think that's a bloody good start.
Thank you, Sasha. Particularly, thank you for not standing up in your sauna. That's most appreciated.
Tell you why, last but standing up.
No. Yeah, we'll edit that out. Don't worry about it. It won't go out in the live version. And last but by no means least, Charlie, do you have a question for Chris?
I do. I'm going to try and manage the sound. What a great advert for not doing our show live in person. How bad we are at all the tech.
I can't believe that, you two couldn't work out that if you're in the same room, you're going to get feedback. I mean, that's just so vintage.
Yes, indeed. Sorry about that. Chris, my question really goes back to the CMA's recommendations. And what I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, of the various recommendations that they have put forward for addressing the identified problems that they found, what in your view are the most implementable? What in your view will have the most impact?
So I suppose, you know, say day to day first before maybe start getting to the more kind of meaty stuff, you know, the statutory review of statutory consultees. Yes, that's already underway. You know, that is probably the number one issue, delaying schemes and preventing schemes from coming forward at the minute. So that is a hugely welcome step that that's already in play. We don't quite know the outcomes of the review that's been ongoing for the last couple of months, but fantastic to see the CMA kind of endorse that review as well, and particularly look at, you know, not just kind of maybe rationalizing this to consultees, but is there a redeemed green light if they don't respond, for example. You know, that is a hugely positive step. And then as well, and I mentioned it earlier, planning fees got to be ring fenced to it. I think you absolutely cannot get away from that. And I think internally, you know, we've had a few discussions, and I have no idea how robust this actually is, but I think it was just put on the too difficult pile when the government did their planning fee increase. It was great to increase, but I think you've got to amend some pretty fundamental legislation. I think whether it's Local Government Finance Act or something like that, to actually ring fence those fees. So it's put on the too difficult pile. So that absolutely needs to be revisited. And then, like I said, the kind of more meaty stuff that the CMA recommended, housing targets, you know, absolutely unambiguous clear national and then from a personal perspective, regional housing targets, I think would be fantastic to it. And I think quite easily implementable, you know, and whether that is continuing to look at household projections, which the CMA look into, or whether that's maybe a move to like a stock-based increase approach, which we've talked about, which the HBF, I think, recently talked about in, I don't know if it's a 10-point plan that they put out at the tail end of last year. So you can't, again, get away from that. And then probably getting to the end, really proper enforcement and monitoring of local plans and actually properly incentivizing those local plans to come forward. So do you look at linking HIF funding, for example, to an up-to-date local plan? If you haven't got an up-to-date local plan in place that sets out your economic and infrastructure priorities, can you access that funding? I think would be a massive character, actually getting those local plans in place. If you don't have a local plan in place, you haven't got a look in to it. And then getting that along with, you know, effective sticks, really. You know, I don't think we can absolutely not look at, say, financially penalizing local authorities. They're in a dire state, so you can't say we're going to take more money away from you or, you know, cut funding. But I think those kind of positive financial incentives, but also, you know, having real planning sticks associated with it. So strengthening the presumption in favour if you haven't got an up-to-date local plan in place, for example. You know, you look at the brownfield presumption that's going through consultation at the minute. Yes, it's obviously very limited and of an odd consultation, I suppose, in my eyes, but, you know, is there scope there for that to be rolled out a bit further, that strength and presumption, if you haven't got a local plan in place? So more effective kind of carrot sticks, monitoring, incentivization for that. And then very lastly, I think it goes back to what I've said a couple of times, that diversity of player on the pitch. I think looking at local plans and looking at more effective policies, say for SMEs, you know, not just requiring, you know, 10% or looking at them through windfall sites, but actually allocating specific sites for SMEs on there. And I think that would potentially go, how robust that'll be or how well that'll work, I don't know. But I think that would be a really good step.
Thanks, Chris. Really, really fascinating thoughts there. Back to you, Paul.
That was Charlie's notes to turn his microphone off. And guess what? It worked this time around. I'm most impressed. Chris, thank you very much indeed. We've had a lot of traction in relation to the chat, particularly in relation to this notion of having a delivery strategy, which includes potentially opening up big sites to other players in relation to that. Maybe a delivery strategy at the time of consent, maybe something to think about. So what we'll do is, as with all our guests, we'll copy all the comments and the questions, and we'll make sure those go to Chris. I was particularly struck with Dave McMullen's comment that he's just got consent for 500-odd, plus lots of other stuff. CY will know where. Allocated site, not one objection. Delegated powers, took 855 days to get consent. Lack of resource and local authority and consultees was a factor. That's your object study in one paragraph.
Yeah.
And the CMA report undoubtedly validates that experience, and self-evidently government needs to do something about it, of whichever hue. So, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. And back to you, Charlie. And I will now turn my microphone off.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. We're getting the hang of this now, finally, just as the show comes to an end. Thank you. You're absolutely right, Paul. I mean, the number of cases probably all of us have done that have either been non-determination or allocated sites or both as a proportion of planning appeals that we've done over the last year or more is extraordinary. So I agree with that. Chris, thank you. I think the number of comments, the range of comments, both in the chat and the Q&A, here is the man himself finally escaped his laptop. The number of comments says everything, actually, about the importance of this issue, this report, and the value that your perspective has offered today. We probably could have gone on for another hour talking through this. So heartfelt thanks. As Paul said, we'll send you on the questions and comments for further consideration. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time for our last episode before Easter, which is in the afternoon after the LPDF lunch, which sounds like a good idea right now. Hopefully we'll all be coherent by 5:30 of that day. But in the meantime, take care, look after yourselves. Thanks again, Chris. Please don't forget the charity donation. Have a look at our website for the details, and we'll see you soon. Thank you very much indeed. Cheers.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.